From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, state lawmakers say yes to the MEEP and no to the Smarter Balanced Assessment Test in Michigan schools.
And so Michigan has been deeply involved in developing these questions and preparing the test. And the group, Smarter Balanced, has really said that they're not really sure what this move may do for Michigan's role in that.
Plus, what's it like walking around all of the Great Lakes?
Generally, I feel very connected to the environment and to these lakes. And that long walk gives me time to have long thoughts.
And we've all heard of Cabernet, Merlot, and Chardonnay. Those wines have been around for centuries. But
who ever heard of Marquette or La Crescent?
We will learn about a new type of wine grape that's made its way to Michigan. Those stories and much more today for you on Stateside. State lawmakers burned plenty of midnight oil last week, passing a flurry of measures before they left for their summer break. That included a provision in the school aid budget that stalls plans to switch Michigan's standardized student tests to the new Smarter Balanced exams, the test aligned with the Common Core standards. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, what does that mean for students who are being taught to Common Core and then tested with the more than 40-year-old MEEP? That story later this hour. But first, there are only a few session days planned before state lawmakers return for 3 weeks of session September 9th. And just the way students end their school year with a report card, so too should our elected representatives be measured in how effectively they tackled the issues important to Michigan. Detroit Free Press Lansing Bureau reporter Kathy Gray broke it down for us in terms of pass, fail, or incomplete. Kathy, there was such a hue and cry when lawmakers left for the summer without passing that plan to pay for fixing the roads. But you're saying that shouldn't necessarily overshadow the fact there have been some important things done since the start of this year?
There have been. They passed a minimum wage increase. They passed a historic bill to help bail out Detroit. And there were a number of other things that they did. Unfortunately, roads is what everybody was so focused on in the last 2 weeks that it kind of sucked all the air out of the room for everything else.
Well put.
And,
yeah.
and they didn't get that done. So that's what people are remembering and kind of forgetting about everything else.
But as you point out in your story for the Free Press, especially the passing the grand bargain and raising the minimum wage, those actions showed a refreshing spirit of bipartisan cooperation, didn't they?
They really did, and surprisingly so. Especially in the House, the grand bargain passed with supermajorities. It was a little bit closer in the Senate, but they came together and passed those. Now, the minimum wage had a little bit more intrigue involved because
yes,
it kind of stunted the ballot proposal that might end up being on the ballot and will be virtually a symbolic vote, and that's it. But, yeah, they got a few things done.
Well, you've broken down some other issues in terms of pass, incomplete, and fail, just like a good report card. So let's start with pass. That scrap metal measure got through.
Mm-hmm. And that was a big deal. It's become a real burden in both urban and rural settings in Detroit and Pontiac and some of the other big cities. Scrappers are just ripping these places apart and taking all the copper and the wire and everything that they can. And even in rural, the wind turbines, a lot of the copper wire and machinery from inside those is getting stolen. Farm equipment is getting stolen and sold for scrap. So this makes it a little bit more difficult for scrappers to get. They've got to wait for payment on these things that are stolen all the time. Copper wire, catalytic converters, air conditioning, heating units are the big three. And it's going to be harder for them to be selling that. And it creates a registry for those people, so it'll make it easier for the police and prosecutors to go after the people who are illegally scrapping.
And another issue that did clear through, the idea that phone companies will be able to now phase out traditional landline services starting in 2017. And we have talked to people who are not real thrilled at that prospect. Was this something that was basically designed to make the phone companies happier, or is this...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Senior citizens were real upset about this. You know, they've had their landlines for years, and they're worried that... But they don't like the voice over internet protocol, which is the cable provided landlines. They don't think that they're as reliable, and right now they're not. If you're in a dead zone, you're going to have a problem with it. But it gives the phone companies 3 years to build up those networks, and hopefully the networks will be built out and there won't be too many people left in dead zones. But senior citizens were worried about it, and so was law enforcement, because they were afraid that 911 calls they might not be able to get through. So it was definitely a controversial issue. They did a few things to the bill that doesn't make it as onerous, so it passed pretty easily. And AT&T is the biggest beneficiary of this legislation. They're the ones that that are the primary providers of traditional landline service.
In the category of incomplete, there are there's some issues that really do get a lot of attention. The EAA, that expansion bill stalled out in the Senate, didn't it?
It did, and there was lots of rumors running around on Thursday that the Senate was going to try to take this up and push it through in the final hours of the legislative session. And there was one senator who had a stack of papers that was probably about an inch and a half thick. He said 56,000 word speech that he was planning to give to try to stall the vote on it. So there was a lot of people who are very, very much against the Democrats hate the EAA, and there's no way that they're going to vote for it. And in the end, I think that the Rhodes issue just kind of, you know, took all the energy out of the room, and so they decided not to run the EAA bill until perhaps in September.
And looking at fails, tax cuts, no-fault auto insurance, and that plan to perhaps allow increases in speed limits on certain roads, I think tax cuts hits most people in the wallet.
Sure. There were tax cuts approved in both the House and the Senate, income tax cuts. There was also a homestead property tax credit that was increased for low-income people. And the House and the Senate realized that when their revenue estimates came in, that they were going to have about $300 million less in tax revenues coming in than they anticipated. And so there was the realization that they just didn't have the money to give tax cuts to people at this point anyway.
And it looks like nothing is happening immediately with reforming our no-fault auto insurance or boosting those speed limits. In fact, you were saying that the speed limit hasn't even gotten a hearing, has it?
No. You know, no fault is just a real sticky one. Whenever they have these hearings on the no-fault insurance, lots of people who have been catastrophically injured in accidents come in to testify, and it's very hard to vote against those folks. And so every time it's come up, it's just fizzled.
Detroit Free Press, Lansing Bureau reporter Kathy Gray giving us a review of the last 6 months of action from the state legislature. And on tomorrow's Stateside, we're going to look at why the legislature fumbled the road funding issue and what comes next. Kathy, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Cynthia.
We've all heard and probably enjoyed drinking Cabernet, Merlot, and Chardonnay. Those wines have been around for centuries. But what about Frontenac, Marquette, and La Crescent? Those grapes have only been around a decade or so, and they can withstand harsh winters, and they can thrive. Stateside's Emily Fox reports from the Upper Peninsula to see if the UP has what it takes to develop a new wine region in the state.
Where's my dog? Come on. Come on.
After working in state politics, Dave Anthony has returned home to the Upper Peninsula.
There's a thicker accent up there than there is. A little different up there. It's more Upper.
Now he and his wife own and run a 4.5-acre vineyard and winery outside of Escanaba. And you might be thinking, what? Wine that far north?
What, are you crazy? And I think there's still some shock out there that it actually works. The first reaction was beyond, are you crazy? It was like, it's stupidity, just total stupidity.
Because it's cold here. This winter, temperatures in January and February were often well below zero and bottomed out at 25 below.
This was a brutal winter.
But Anthony's growing what's called cold hardy wine grapes, and they can withstand that kind of cold. Many of these wine grapes were created by the University of Minnesota. It released its first cold hardy grape in 1996. And since then, wine regions are popping up in places once unimaginable. In the past two decades, Minnesota has tripled the number of wineries in the state to 30, and Iowa more than tripled the amount of grapes it's growing. But Anthony says the biggest challenge is the lack of name recognition for his wines.
Who ever heard of Marquette or La Crescent?
Hello, welcome to Northern Sun Winery.
The tasters at Anthony's winery don't mind.
This red wine has a very good bouquet
Larry Pilon and his wife are visiting from Ann Arbor. He actually grew up just down the road.
Having come from this area, this has been a depressed area for so long. It's nice to see something that's thriving and growing. And
the Pilons bought 6 bottles, but the real wine business is in Traverse City.
The total is 5406.
Because it's warmer, the vineyards can grow the European varieties like Merlot and Pinot Grigio.
Hope you all enjoy the wines.
Charlie Edson is the owner at Bel Lago Winery near Traverse City. He grows 100 varieties of grapes on his vineyard, including some cold hardy ones. But he says customers like to buy wines with names that they know.
I don't see the cold hardy varieties being more than just a small portion of the industry here in Traverse City. And it's because the vinifera do so well and they're so well known, and that's what wineries are building their reputation on.
Edson says the biggest criticism of these new grapes in terms of taste is that they don't have the same structure and character as the centuries-old wines like Cabernet. But Edson says cold hardy grapes are a type of crop insurance, considering, well, 2 words, polar vortex.
There's winter injury in the vineyards right now, in most vineyards. And I can tell you that the cold hardy varieties, they laughed in the face of this winter. And so we're going to have full crops of all of our cold hardy varieties, which is terrific.
And that's not the case for most European varieties this year. But back in the UP, Anthony thinks this might be a wake-up call for grape growers, which might allow cold hardy grapes to expand and grow even further in the future. For Stateside, I'm Emily Fox.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we're starting a new series about music. We're calling it What's the Song That Saved Your Life? Stateside's Kyle Norris asked a lot of people that question. Is there a song that saved your life? She found sometimes people have an immediate answer. Other times people really have to think about it. And of course, for plenty of people, the answer is no. She got all of these answers and more when she spoke with folks at a bowling alley in Wayne, Michigan.
This can be a tricky question. A lot of people haven't ever really thought of music or a song in this particular way. And the question can quickly take you into personal and often tender territory. But the people at Wayne Bowl, in the city of Wayne, between Detroit and Ypsilanti, were pretty good sports. Mac Ivory Sr. was at the bowling alley with 2 generations of his family that night. He was there along with Mac Ivory III and Mac Ivory Jr. And Mac Ivory Sr. didn't so much have an answer to the question as much as he just wanted to sing.
The name of it is so long. Now, this is way back in the 40s. Gee, I hate to see you go. You are the one that I know. You've been mine so long, all along. With my memories of you, I can see that you're lonely too. You're my own, even though we're far apart. But I'll keep you right here in my heart so long. And that's it.
So long.
So long. So long.
Turns out that song was originally by Nolan Strong and the Diablos. That's a Detroit doo-wop group that was popular in the 50s.
I was in a bar. Matter of fact, I was a bouncer in the bar. So that's where I heard that.
Who's gonna love you the way that I...
Ivory is 89, and he was born and raised in Detroit, but he now lives in Inkster. He says the song brings back tears because his wife is gone, but he's still here. Now, sometimes when you ask people, what's the song that saved your life, you get a taste of a bigger story. That's what bartender Valerie Martin seemed to be getting at as she mentioned a few of the songs that saved her life.
One reminds me of a friend that passed away at 17, and I was 17, so still to this day, it's like yesterday, and that song comes on. Summer 69, Brian Adams was the one that reminded me of my friend. I ain't singing it, though. But I'd say summer 89, because that was my year with her.
Death came up a lot in people's answers, which makes me think during a very difficult time, a song can do something powerful by comforting us.
My name is Juanita Saylor. I live in Inkster, Michigan.
The most important song in her life is Amazing Grace.
It was my mother's favorite song, and she passed away when I was a little girl. I was brought up in church as a child every Sunday, so I guess it kind of stuck with me from my early childhood days. Down south, there was not a lot of songs that people knew because, you know, there was no books, no hymn books that you could pass out every Sunday and learn a song from. It was, you know, in the south, in the country, so just brings back a lot of memories.
Not everyone has a song that saved their life. But then you meet a guy like Troy Gray from Romulus.
I was riding in my car one day in the express lane, rolling on the freeway.
My life? I was a bad kid, pretty much. Not listening to my parents, stealing stuff from them, and getting in trouble, big trouble.
His jam was called You Saved Me by R. Kelly.
A while ago, I stole merchandise from a JCPenney store, and I was caught and arrested for it. And it pretty much being arrested just at that time, not really going to jail or anything, just being put in a holding cell changed my whole perspective. Being able to be in being processed, and it really changed everything. Like, this is not how I want to be.
10 years I've been straight. You saved me.
And nobody really ever makes songs like that. And when I just heard the lyrics and everything, and it pretty much inspired me, you know, I need to change. I need to better myself for my own future. It's pretty much the chorus saying, you saved me, gave me a second chance, you saved me. And that really right there, that part right there, let me know that everybody deserves a second chance. There's a second chance out there. If you don't believe that you don't get a second chance, there is a second chance. What did I do differently? I stopped stealing. I got married. Changed my life around getting married to this lady right behind me. I've been married for about a year and a half now.
All this week, we're going to hear from people who say one song saved their life. And we want to hear from you. Do you have a song that saved your life? Tell us the story. Call us and let us know. You can call 248-962-3806. You can also use the hashtag SongSavedMe on Twitter. Stateside's Kyle Norris produced our series, and she may even use your story on the air. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Last Thursday afternoon, the 2014 World Cup began as Brazil and Croatia ran out onto the pitch in Brazil. And with that, fans of association football, a.k.a. soccer here in the USA, plunged into a month of the High Holy Days World Cup action. Now, many fans of the beautiful game get downright nationalistic as they cheer on their favorite team, whether it be England, Italy, Brazil, Germany, Italy, of course the USA, which opens its World Cup bid this evening at 6 against Ghana. One thing will really leap out at you when you watch videos of matches from around the world: the different styles of very excited broadcasters when their team scores a goal. There's the Latin American style, where the word goal matters most of all.
Mira el centro, clara, gol!
Over to Italy, where a soccer goal means emotions will run high and tears may well be shed.
Goal! Goal! Terrore! Goal! 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 Ed è gol! Ed è gol! Errore! Errore d'orrore!
The British announcers, like Roy Hudson here, just pour on the metaphors and similes, searching for ways to describe the apparent miracle of that kick into the net.
This one drops in!
Are you
kidding
me?
It's ecstasy!
Astonishing! This is not just a dream, it's a wet dream of orgasmic proportions. And this one deludes everybody. It seduces everybody in Real Madrid's fan club, that's for sure.
Throughout the European continent, often into the Middle East, Announcers seem to focus on the name of the goal scorer, drawing out the syllables in a Latin American style or punching them out rhythmically like the Italians. Here's a Dutch announcer celebrating a goal by Dennis Bergkamp. And I promise you will have no doubt who scored this goal.
Heel goed naar Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp neemt de bal aan. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp.
And then there's Spain, where announcers squeeze every bit of mileage possible out of those vowels, consonants, and syllables, as in this call for Barcelona.
Goal, 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 goal. Titi, 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 goal.
Well, unlike those hyper-emotive broadcasters, if you think the playing style of your favorite team somehow reflects some deep cultural trait of that country, my next guest says, think again. Andy Markovitz is a University of Michigan political scientist and lifelong soccer fan. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you so much.
When you look at these World Cup teams, they are made up of players from that country, unlike the professional teams where anything goes. You have the best players going to the highest bidder, and national origin doesn't matter. So you have Real Madrid or Barcelona or Chelsea or Manchester City. They're all a League of Nations playing for them, but not the World Cup. But yet you don't think that the playing style of each team reflects its country's culture?
Well, first of all, I'm not quite sure what a country's culture is. Mm. That's number one. And these are very often very, very dangerous generalizations, which are, of course, immensely facile and sound also very learned. But they're often wrong. The argument, of course, is that somehow these purported national characteristics, which I even question, but let's assume they exist.
Give us an example. Give us Germany. I mean, you know, let's say Germany.
Germany. Germany's organized, stout, kind of solid, disciplined, and basically boring. Contrast with Brazil, which is jogo bonito, which is dancing, which is samba-like, which plays by intuition, completely spurns any kind of preparation. It's all in their blood. This is, of course, nonsense.
And is there a USA image?
No, there isn't. And by the way, for important reason, okay. There isn't, because soccer is, in fact, has not been what I have called in my work a hegemonic sport in the United States, meaning that, in fact, people have not followed it en masse the way they follow baseball, basketball, football, and hockey.
Absolutely,
okay?
Absolutely.
And so
soccer is something you take your 10-year-old daughter
exactly,
to.
Exactly.
In
and
this
by the
country.
Way, that's also very new. That's
yes.
Also in, this, in the 70s. When I came here from Europe, no one knew soccer in the 60s. Nobody.
Right.
Then it became kind of a suburban sport. Girls played it and Latinos played it. I don't have time to go into why the U.S. has a different history in its sports. Just suffice it to say that we developed our sports earlier and at the same time that this game was actually exported from Britain or England, to be specific, between 1880 and 1920, with the rest of the world, actually Latin America and Europe, assuming it. So basically what happens is that only sports that are massively followed, that become culture, that are more than just those that play it, assume a certain kind of style. So, in fact, in America, we have it too, except all American sports are not American, but in fact, internal. So we have a West Coast playing football basically the Big Ten football, and which, in fact, does exist, but has nothing to do with the fact that somehow, people from Ohio and Michigan are stout and tough
and solid,
and people from California are kind of cool. But it has something to do with institutions. And my argument is that there
are... Circling back to soccer.
Going back to soccer, yeah. Exactly. That there is actually a certain style that teams play. But in fact, they've played it because of a coach. They play it because of a school. They play it because of a particular response to another style. but it has nothing to do with purported national character. So, for example, the best example for me is Italy.
Yeah.
Italy, we see Italians, not only we, everybody sees Italians as dolce far niente, as wonderful, as singing, and, well, you know, basically this kind of dolce vita, okay?
Yes, yes.
Well, their soccer style until recently was exactly the opposite. Something called catenaccio, which means door bolt. And they play this deeply defensive, destructive, ugly a game, which was purported to, I mean, basically predicated on very quick sort of surgical attacks that win by one goal. And then you immediately recede and play this kind of destructive, non-flashy style at all.
So anything except live and let live.
Exactly. Yeah. And this completely contradicts the alleged Italian sort of happy, tasteful,
live and let live. Exactly.
Live and let live kind of stylish of a game. And of course, there is no national characteristics. I mean, think about Germany. Germany until but the first half of the 20th century was seen as the most bellicose nation in the world. Or certainly in Europe, as having started two world wars, on and on and on. I mean, they were associated with soldiers, okay? Mm-hmm. In the meantime, Germany has become this completely peace-loving nation. In fact, so much so that they don't want to do anything. And in fact, the United States often prods, and others in Europe prod Germany to live up also militarily to its economic might.
Now, I have to say, why do you think this national characteristics as explanation of playing style, why is this so enduring?
Because it's very simple.
And it's fun.
It's fun. And it's easy. And it's perpetuated all the time. And even such learned people as Henry Kissinger wrote a very, very famous op-ed piece, I forget now which World Cup, 94 or 98, in which he completely perpetuates this. And it's kind of, you know, you sound – soccer is a very, very difficult game to analyze – because there's actually very few numbers, and so I'm actually always very disappointed in the color commentators. The color commentators at soccer games are completely useless to me because they very often – they don't tell me what the strategy really is. And also, by the way, it's a flowing game, so there's no stoppages. You cannot discuss things the way you do in all American sports.
Correct.
Okay? So you can't – and this then lends itself – you have to say something learned. You have to say something. So you say, oh, they play, you know, because a pass comes in beautifully, whatever, or solidly, they play German. And if they dribble, they're Brazilian or they're this. And, you know, it continues. And especially, by the way, since you talked about the beginning, how in many ways – soccer or football has completely changed by virtue of it being so international on the club level.
Yes.
I mean, what does this mean that these guys are yesterday's Argentinian players? I mean, they play for Manchester City and Barcelona. What does this mean? They're Argentinians by passport.
Right.
I mean, so you know, Zabaleta and Aguero play for Manchester City. And play together with Bosnians,
it's the League of Nations.
Exactly.
And owned by, for example, Chelsea, case, owned by a Russian.
Russia.
Man United,
owned by the Glazers.
Yeah, yeah.
Manchester
Americans.
City, exactly. Manchester City owned. But the owner, yeah, exactly. But the point is that they are, that, and they play a style which has nothing to do with their nationalism. That's what I'm really arguing here in these pieces.
University of Michigan political scientist and lifelong fan of the beautiful game, Andy Markovitz. Good to have you with us, Andy.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. One of the many decisions made by state lawmakers during the budget actions last week was to keep the MEEP in place for another year. The more than 40-year-old MEEP exam stays put, even though Michigan adopted the Common Core state standards in 2010. And the state's education department has been working for the past 3 years to bring in the new testing aligned to the Common Core. That new test is called the Smarter Balanced Assessment. Brian Smith's been reporting on the Common Core and Smarter Balanced versus MEEP tussle for MLive. Brian, State Superintendent Mike Flanagan stated very clearly in April the MEEP was, in his words, not an option. What happened last week during the budget process in the House?
Well, the debate had been on whether or not the state was going to keep the MEEP and leave that in place. And there was an amendment in the House, on the House floor, that actually inserted a requirement in the state education budget that said that the Department of Education, is actually going to have to develop a new MEEP exam for next year, and that provision stayed through the budget as it went through conference committee and is actually in the bill that was passed last week.
So, boom, they throw this card down on the table. And what does this mean for, let's start with the school administrators and the principals and the education department. They've been trying to get Smarter Balanced ready to be given next year. Can they hit the reverse button and go back to MEEP?
Well, that's certainly a fair question. As you pointed out, Superintendent Flanagan has said that his department simply can't have a MEEP ready for next year. I've spoken with some folks at the department as this issue has moved forward, and they've indicated that they're evaluating their options and starting to talk to testing vendors to figure out what they can possibly get done. Lawmakers I've spoken with have said that they understand that this is not going to be necessarily taking the MEEP test that everyone's been taking for the last 40 years and just rolling that out an extra year. It's going to have to be a new MEEP, as they put it. That sort of reflects some of the changes that have been made, but there's some real hesitation about using the Smarter Balance tests that the state's been working on.
What's behind that? Because I wondered, was this more about state lawmakers showing Superintendent Flanagan who's the boss, or is it deep distrust of Smarter Balanced?
Well, it's a little of both. I think a big concern that a lot of people have had is that the Smarter Balance tests are given using a computer, and they're called computer adaptive, which means the next question that each student gets is based on their responses to the past question. So the test sort of finds the level that the students are at, and there have been a lot of concerns about doing that because of the technology requirements. Every student has to have a device, whether it's a computer or a tablet or something like that, to take the test on, and there has to be sufficient internet connections and bandwidth for all the students in particular grades to be testing at one time. There's a larger testing window than would be used for the traditional MEEP, but there are some lawmakers that are concerned about how long testing will take. Estimates say it's about the same as the MEEP, but some people say that in practice it may be as much as twice as long, something like 15 or 16 hours.
Brian, is the distrust more than about the way the test is administered to the students as opposed to content?
Well, there are some concerns about content, and more specifically, how much control Michigan really has over the content. Now, Michigan is what's called a governing state in the consortium, the group that's developing the tests.
Right.
And Deputy Superintendent Joe Martineau is actually the co-chair of the group's executive committee. And so Michigan has been deeply involved in developing these questions and preparing the test. And the group, Smarter Balance, has really said that they're not really sure what this move may do for Michigan's role in that, because while there's not a firm commitment to the group that they're going to use these tests next year, the work has certainly been progressing on the idea that Michigan would be implementing these tests.
And another twist, Superintendent Flanagan has said that if we keep using MEEP, it could cost Michigan federal title money of about $1 billion. Can you explain this for us?
Yeah, it's confusing. It's not directly lost, and those dollars would still come into the state from the federal government. But the state's waiver from No Child Left Behind, feds actually call it the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, basically says that when they got that waiver, they got a lot more flexibility in how they can spend those dollars in exchange for doing things like implementing a test that measures student growth, putting in teacher evaluations, the things that the state's been working on. And so if the state is in violation of that waiver, then the federal government could decide to revoke that waiver or not renew it, which would be more likely in this case, as the state's waiver technically expires at the end of the school year. And so by doing that, all the restrictions in federal law on how that money can be spent would come back into force. And the big ones would be schools would have to offer more testing or more tutoring services, rather, and you'd have mandatory transportation for schools of choice so that parents could send their child to another school if they wanted to, and they would have to be transported because all the schools in the state would be considered not making adequate progress under No Child Left Behind in that case.
So when the quote that I saw in a piece you did for MLive in April was Superintendent Flanagan saying, we will lose title money of about $1 billion.
It's somewhere in that neighborhood. Estimates range from about 800 million to about a billion. Again, some lawmakers have said that's not entirely accurate because that money would still come in. It's just how we spend it. Hmm. Representative Lisa Lyons, who's chair of the House Education Committee, has made that point that we're still going to get that money. It's just how we spend it, and it's maybe not necessarily a bad thing, as she put it, to spend that money on increased tutoring and things like transportation for schools of choice.
And then there are some lawmakers pushing to move oversight of student testing to the Michigan Treasury. Is this a case of them wanting to put education in the naughty chair?
That's actually how at least a couple of lawmakers have described it, as a timeout for bad behavior, because the Department of Education and the Michigan State Board of Education, which constitutionally has oversight of how the state runs its schools but not the purse strings for what they spend on it, made the decision to go with Smarter Balance. There were some agreements that were signed actually back under Governor Granholm to start moving toward implementing the Common Core and implementing these tests. And so there have been some concerns that maybe the Department of Education is not as responsive to lawmakers and answering questions about these things, and that decisions are being made that the legislature is not being consulted on that are going to take money out of the state treasury. So moving oversight back to treasury where it was for several years has been floated as a way to sort of change the culture at the Department of Education and make those folks more responsive to questions from lawmakers.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a warning shot across the bow.
It certainly seems to be, although there were bills in both the House and the Senate to make that move that advanced out of committee to the floor before the break, and they haven't gone anywhere since then. And the budget that was actually approved by the legislature still refers to making the Department of Education develop the new MEAT test and be in charge of it. So it seems like that push may have died down once these budget provisions were put in place.
Brian, what happens next school year? I'm thinking of parents with children who are going to be tested. What are we going to see happen, do you think?
That is still an excellent question. When you talk to folks out in the state and even folks in the Department of Education, they're still trying to figure out what this is really going to mean. Obviously, while the budget's been approved, it hasn't been signed into law yet. That'll still have to happen. But once that happens, the Department of Ed is likely going to have to figure out how to develop a new MEAT test, and it's not clear if that would be given in the fall, as the MEAT traditionally has been, or in the spring, which is when the Smarter Balance tests were set to be given, because the idea with the Smarter Balance test was you give it in the spring so that you can see how students have progressed from the start of the year to the end, rather than testing what they've forgotten over the summer.
Mm. What are you hearing from parents?
I've had several parents speak to me as I've been out in the community and talking with folks. Parents really just would like to see the legislature take a step back from making all these decisions and let the education experts at the Department of Ed and at the school start making the decisions of what we need to be testing, how we need to be testing it, and really just let the educators make the decisions for education and let the lawmakers decide how much money we're going to spend.
What should we watch for now?
Again, we have to wait and see, you know, if there are any vetoes that might come through the budget that could affect some of these provisions, although I don't think that's likely. Mm. But once it does, it's going to be a case of how quickly can the Michigan Department of Education get a MEAT test ready, and what that's going to look like, how it's going to be given, when it's going to be given.
Many things up in the air. MLive reporter Brian Smith, thanks for the update.
Thank you very much.
No one can dispute that my next guest loves the Great Lakes like few others. First, she hiked completely around Lake Michigan, her 1,000-mile walk on the beach. Then she decided to hike the shorelines of all five Great Lakes, another 1,000-mile adventure. She's turned both of those into books. And now she's working on her third journey, a 1,000-mile Great Lakes island adventure. Lorene Neuenheis, it's so good to see you again.
Nice to see you again, Cindy.
Well, you can't get enough, can you?
I can't, no.
I think you've hiked a cumulative about 2,000 miles around the Great Lakes, and now it's the islands of the Great Lakes for another 1,000-mile adventure, hiking and boating and kayaking and bicycling. But there are tens of thousands of islands. How did you decide?
There are. So I did have to whittle it down. I am not visiting every island. But
don't have many lifetimes to do that.
Exactly. There were some obvious choices. pieces. And I actually looked for research projects where I could help the scientists with these projects. So the Manitou Islands, north and south, were an obvious choice because the piping plover research and monitoring goes on every summer there. And then Isle Royale, they have the longest running predator-prey study ever done on that island up in Lake Superior. So I wanted to help with that, the moose-wolf study.
Where else did you go?
I have visited three islands on the west side of Lake Michigan, Cana Island, which is near the Door Peninsula, Washington Island, and Rock Island. So I got the Wisconsin flavor of the islands over there. And I did Lake Erie Islands last year. I did Kelly's Island, which has some of the most pronounced glacial grooves anywhere in the world. There's this long stretch of limestone that has been carved. It looks like a master carver went in there and carved these this limestone slab out into beautiful. It's like reverse columns laying down for like a whole 4-acre section there.
The idea that you are engaging with scientific research as you visit the islands, that's something you haven't done in your previous two books and your previous two adventures.
Correct. That hasn't really presented itself. I have stopped in at different research stations and interviewed scientists and talked to people about how to control the lamprey and other places where I was able to interface with scientists. But I have a scientific background. I have a Master of Science, and I worked in cancer research for years. So I kind of love being plugged back in to this world and into the natural science arena, which I just love, and I've learned so much.
Out of the laboratory and into the forest.
Yes.
You just recently got back from Isle Royale. Tell us what you did.
I did. I was part of the group that went out in late May. There were about 25 of us, and they broke us up into five teams and scattered us around the island and gave us different areas to explore looking for moose bones. So we had to gather moose bones. The scientists especially need the skulls and the metatarsals, which is a long bone in the back leg.
Why?
Depending, they can measure the length of the metatarsal and actually correlate that with if the moose was born and was a young moose during a time where there was a lot of food available or whether it was a time that was kind of rough for that moose. And they've actually been able to correlate early nutrition in moose with the incidence of arthritis later on. And that study, that landmark study, has led to studies done in people, and the same correlation exists for people.
I'm speaking with adventurer and Great Lakes lover Laureen Nieuwenhuis about her latest adventure, which was 1,000 miles visiting various Great Lakes islands. And as we say, with some tens of thousands of islands, there's no way you're going to have to leave some people's favorite islands out of your list. What environmental issues struck you most deeply, Laureen, as you traveled about these islands in the five Great Lakes?
Well, the whole climate change issue is really quite important for Isle Royale because for many years the ice bridge did not form, isolating that island from the mainland. Now, back in 1997, they had a wolf immigrate to the island and reinvigorate the wolf population genetics there. And that was very important for the wolf population there. But until this winter, there had not been an ice bridge that was solid enough for individuals to migrate to the island. And this year, unfortunately, they lost one individual. One female wolf left the island. So there's only 9 wolves left on the island right now. And that's allowing the moose population to grow out of control, which may lead to mass starvation of the moose in coming years.
What did you see in the other islands that struck you or worried you?
As far as environmental concerns, Lake Erie still has a big problem with Microcystis, the blue-green algae. It's actually a bacteria. It's an algal bloom. And I did see a lot of that when I was on the islands. Yeah. And that's quite concerning because you can't filter that out of the water. So a city like Cleveland that's pulling water out of the lake, they have a very difficult time cleaning that up for their population, and it can even give off a gas into the environment where people who are boating out on the lake have gotten nauseous and sick because of it. So that's a big concern for Lake Erie.
Of all your treks, and maybe this is like asking someone to pick their favorite child, can you pick out a favorite place that is closest to your heart as you think of all the areas you've traveled on the shores of the Great Lakes and through these islands?
I think I have to point to Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore as my favorite stretch of beach to walk. And in my second adventure, I was able to stay on the shoreline the entire time. In 2009, when I hiked Lake Michigan, part of that was underwater. The lake was higher. So it was just a joy to be right at the edge of the water for that entire 35 miles in 2012. And Pictured Rocks, I hiked that for my second book also. That's a very close second. It's just a beautiful – I mean, there's a reason these two are national lakeshores.
What's the feeling you get as you're out there on your own? Do you ever feel worried?
Generally, no. I did think a cougar was following me once.
That would worry me.
Yeah. I thought I smelled this musky smell, but it turned out it was just me after hiking in the same clothes for 3 days. But generally, I feel very connected to the environment and to these lakes. And that long walk gives me time to have long thoughts that are connected. I get to think about all the research I've done and the interviews I've done and connect it with what I'm seeing during my walk.
The books are a 1,000-mile walk on the beach and a 1,000-mile Great Lakes walk, containing a lot of environmental stewardship, a lot of love of nature in the Great Lakes. And you will have a third book out next year about your Great Lakes island adventure. Author, explorer, adventurer, and Great Lakes lover, Laureen Nieuwenhuis. So good to see you again. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
Support for Arts and Culture Reporting on Michigan Radio comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for spending your Monday with us.